Hello, welcome to the Majlis, a Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, also happen to be Media Relations Manager for Asian Affairs at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty here in Washington, D.C. Since July 15, coup attempt, enormous changes are taking place in Turkey, in which 240 people were dead and hundreds sustained injury. Blaming the exiled Turkish cleric Fethullah Gulen in orchestrating the attempt, President Erdogan was quick in retaliating against what he suspected to be plotters or suspected supporters of the Gulen. Despite Gulen's rejection of any involvement in the attempt, since July 15th, nearly 100,000 state employees either fired, suspended, or arrested. No doubt security forces have been the main target, while education sector was also hit hard. Calling Gulen a terrorist, Erdogan is now urging all the nations to shut down the Gulen-affiliated schools, mainly to cut off the financial means for a Gulen movement and to also what Erdogan calls possibility of such attempt taking place in those countries by the Gulen supporters. There are nearly 1,000 such schools around the world and tens of them are active in Central Asia. This is where things get little complicated. On one hand, the region is in desperate need of quality educational institutions such as these schools, and on the other hand, leaders are faced putting their relationship with Erdogan in danger. To put it straightly, Central Asian leaders are faced with a big dilemma on how to react. Today in the Majlis, we will try to understand their dilemma, value of those schools to the region, its impact on the society, Erdogan's position, and implication of the possible reaction by Central Asian leaders. To discuss the subject, I have from Kentucky, America, Dr. Alan DeYoung, professor at the University of Kentucky, who has years of teaching experience in Central Asia. From Kyrgyzstan, Asia, Dr. Emil Juraev is joining us, who is professor at the American University in Central Asia. From Europe, I have my colleague Bruce Panier, who is the editor of Kishlok Owozi, a Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. What an amazing panel, gentlemen. Welcome to the Majlis. Let's start with you, Dr. Juraev. Kyrgyzstan is taking strong position against calls by President Erdogan to shut down these schools. Why is that?
Yes, there are several reasons, I believe. Indeed, Kyrgyzstan has been one of the more open and welcoming countries in the recent years regarding relations with Fethullah Gulen-related organizations, and especially in allowing a free possibility of activity for Fethullah Gulen movement. And therefore, it was not surprising that Foreign Minister of Turkey did single out Kyrgyzstan in asking to do something about this organization. Now, the reason why Kyrgyzstan, the president included, would have to take such a strong stand is, I believe, on the one hand, that indeed the graduates of these many schools have already come to take certain important positions in business as well as public service, and the government does have many opportunities to listen and to get their views on these matters. The thing is, probably even more important, is that these 20 or so schools of the related to Gulen are really some of the most high-performing, highly regarded schools in the country, and which are currently, of course, educating many thousands of children, including those who are from well-to-do and influential families. And therefore, it would have been a very publicly sensitive thing for the government of Kyrgyzstan to allow any sort of persecution or otherwise limiting the school's activities in this country. Right. And hence,
Turkish government's position, they would say the reason behind Kyrgyzstan's strong position against this call might has to do with the influence of Gulen to your leadership. Is there any truth in that?
Well, that remains in the eye of the beholder. Basically, because this whole thing about the conspiracy of the Gulen movement against the government of Turkey itself is full of all sorts of conspiracies. We're left to basically just turn on our critical thinking and try to understand what's true and what's not. In Kyrgyzstan, I would say if there is any influence of the people related with the Gulen movement, that influence would seem to be mostly because of very legitimate reasons, that these are successful and very big businessmen and political figures who have important capital. It would not be any wonder that these groups do have some voice and have ability to get listened.
We have some problem with your voice, Dr. Jurayev. We will get back to you shortly. Bruce, what's at stake here? Is it only education, or there is something else behind Kyrgyzstan's position, in your opinion?
Well, we also got to remember that Kyrgyzstan, of course, is a sovereign. Play other people's games for quite a while now. If we look at the recent example of the Russian-Ukrainian conflict, suddenly Russia, which is of course an extremely important partner for Kyrgyzstan, all of a sudden wanted all these countries to take their side in the conflict with Ukraine, and then Russia imposed sanctions on them, and it was ironically, I suppose, it was goods from Turkey that really suffered. They couldn't. Central Asians, Kyrgyzstan included, couldn't export their goods as easily to Ukraine and couldn't receive things from Ukraine. And problems in Turkey, and the Turkish government turns around and says, we want you to close down these schools that are affiliated with Gulen. And I think that's part of it with Kazakhstan, too, is that they got to the point where they were saying, look, we're a sovereign state, and you shouldn't tell us what to do with our own internal policies anymore. So to some extent, I would say that there was an element of resistance to being dictated to by someone outside the country.
Right. Dr. Alan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and Tajikistan nationalized or shut down those schools, and their decision came years earlier when Erdogan had no problem with Gulen. In fact, I have seen those days Erdogan and his close associates visiting those schools in their foreign trips. What was that they have seen so early in those schools in Kyrgyzstan is still missing it?
Well, that's a very good question. Some of those questions I, too, have been interested in, haven't really been able to engage them as much as I would. I want to emphasize them sort of, and you all probably know better than I, the moral and spiritual concerns of Gulen. And it's likely the case that it's the moral teachings of the movement, which I'm not an expert on, which alarmed the government officials in each of those other republics. It used to be in Soviet times there was something called Vospitania, which was a moral upbringing, and it was part of it's arguably, as in the Gulen movement, the social aspect, social and moral aspect was seen in Soviet times as equally important to upbringing of children. And when that all went away in the 1990s, all the states had to figure out what was going to take the place of the moral and spiritual base for the culture. And I think that's what's happened in Turkmenistan and Tajikistan, which I have a little experience in, that they decided that what was being taught by Gulen wasn't what they wanted to be, the spiritual and moral center. And they were pretty quick to say, we're going to take charge of that because we worried about the content. Now, I think that in Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan, probably the alarm bell didn't go off quite the same way, or there was a lot of, there were differences of opinion about what we should do in terms of replacing the moral basis of the culture. I know in Kyrgyzstan that was true, comparing, for example, the North and the South, about who the ethnic heroes are. Who is who is Kyrgyz? Who is Kazakh? Where are the founding myths of the origin of heroes? And I think certainly in Kyrgyzstan, that was a little bit more up for grabs than it has been in Turkmenistan and Tajikistan, where the government said, here's what we want to do, and here's where we want to go, and we know that Gulen doesn't get us there. So that would be my you know, that's sort of my approach. And if I had the opportunity to pursue those and see whether those hypotheses are accurate, I probably would. That's what I'd like. That would be interesting.
Dr. Jirai, Dr. Allen said that the moral values that are attached to Gulen or his affiliates might be the reason behind Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan and Tajikistan came to this decision in early years to shut down those schools. So Kyrgyzstan didn't notice these values that Gulen schools are bringing, or it was okay for Kyrgyzstan, acceptable?
Yes, that's. I think Alan has it very put it very well, that there are differences between these countries, among these countries, in how they have been handling their ideological life, and especially their politics toward Islam. I would add, among Tajikistan and Turkmenistan, of course, Uzbekistan as well, which has closed the Gulen schools more years ago.
Right.
Tajikistan did it just last year. And compared to those countries, I think Kazakhstan and especially Kyrgyzstan did not have an agreed, settled idea, a policy of exactly what Islam, what sort of Islam we are going to teach. And in that regard, I think the Gulen version of Islam, always open to science, modernizing version of Islam, sounded like a welcoming, like an acceptable option, especially in relation to some other darker sorts of Islam being brought from outside. Whereas in the other countries, of course, in Turkmenistan and Tajikistan increasingly, we have the ruling regimes which are dominating over the ideological and moral life of the societies much more monolithically, that no other competitor is welcomed.
From the point of religious conservatism, if you look at Central Asia, you see Uzbekistan and Tajikistan as a highlight of the region. And in the meantime, according to Dr. Allen and Dr. Jirai, they were against an organization which was preaching moral values, which is very closely associated with Islam. What is this contradiction?
Well, you know, we also got to remember, as styles of leadership here. I mean, the leaders of Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan are authoritarian leaders. They have their own vision, but you know, ultimately, it's an individual's vision of the way the country is supposed to be. And I think that the concept, the perception that there was another outside individual's philosophy that might penetrate into their own societies was something that deeply bothered them, especially since it had, you know, it did have the element of Islam in with the education, and leaders of Central Asia, by and large, are not very Islamic. They're not, good Muslims for a long time, certainly in Karimov and Rahman's case, and Nazarbayev, too. They were part of the atheist Soviet bureaucracy, so they don't have those kind of credentials like someone like Gulen would have. So they don't want the competition for a national philosophy or national identity because they have their own idea of the way things are supposed to go. And they're on pretty shaky ground when they try to compete with some of these other people.
Dr. Jirayev, I'm coming back to you. Kazakhstan's position, too, very interesting in this. Nazarbayev seems to have a high regard to quality of those education centers. But during his visit last week to Turkey, he took rather a kind of confusing position from my point of view, leaving everyone wonder about his next step about those schools. How do you read this, and what's going to happen next in Kazakhstan, where they stand in this controversy?
Well, compared to Kyrgyzstan's position on many of these recent controversial situations, President Nazarbayev has always led a much softer, more mediated diplomatic tone. And I think what President Nazarbayev had to say to his counterpart in Turkey is that indeed Kazakhstan does sympathize with the worries and with the problems that Turkey has been facing, that they take the warnings and the Turkish government seriously and with sympathy, and that if there is any confirmed reason for taking some serious actions against these schools, that Kazakhstan stands ready to do that. At the same time, he did remind that these schools have generally been performing very well, and they have never shown any suspicious or otherwise politically unacceptable sort of behavior. And I think not really closing down the schools, but at the same time, not overly displeasing the partners in Ankara.
Right. Just to recap, today we are discussing President Erdogan and Gulen's feud in Central Asia over Gulen-affiliated schools and dilemma that Central Asian leaders are facing on how to react to President Erdogan's call to shut down those schools. Discussing the subject with me are Dr. Alan Diang, professor at the University of Kentucky, who has years of experience, teaching experience, I should say, in Central Asia. Dr. Emil Jurai, professor at the American University in Central Asia. Bruce Panier is joining me from Prague, who is the editor of Kishlak Awazi, a Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I am Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. In this part of the debate, let's try to understand two things. First, Erdogan says he believes that Gulen has a global agenda. His supporters can overthrow governments in those countries. I have to repeat that Gulen strongly dispute this claim. Second, what those schools about? What impact they are having on society, and why is that some countries are strongly standing behind them and some shutting them down or already shut down in early years, even at the cost of irritating Turkish government of that time? I wish I have had a participation of some people who share similar views with Erdogan, but my attempts to secure their participation hasn't been successful. Several people I spoke to have agreed to share their opinions off the record. Several stepped away, saying it is too dangerous to talk about, and one or two who agreed to be in the Majlis are missing in the last minute. Similarly, the Gulen supporters I spoke to were not ready to go on the record, citing their own security. It's an interesting situation that every side blames the opponent. But the fact is that this is no game in Central Asia, where leaders are faced with dilemma on how to react, and their decisions are going to have long-term effect on society. So, Dr. Jurai, I know those schools were one of the first helping hands to arrive to Central Asia very soon after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Then it was welcomed by all those governments, including Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan. Tell me the early days of their arrival to Central Asia, especially Kyrgyzstan, how it happened.
Well, my memory is not very good on this, because I never had to deal with the Gulen schools. I didn't study there. But I do remember that as soon as they started to arrive, they were quite competitive from the very beginning. Now, I must say, in the early years, however, there were many more debates and misgivings about these schools from the society which was not involved in these schools. So there were many more debates about who Fethullah Gulen is. There were many more kind of dark guesses about the dictatorial figure who is not known, never seen by anyone in Kyrgyzstan, and somehow runs these schools. And there were lots of rumors about how these schools tend to indoctrinate and brainwash the kids. But over the years, these schools have pretty much very solidly won the respect and the recognition of the wider society. By now, you rarely come by any kind of doubters among the Kyrgyz society about the purposes or the trustworthiness of these schools. This change over some years, over say 5 to 10 years, the change has really been won because of the performance of the schools and because of the interaction that people actually get to know these schools. More and more people go to schools, or they know people who go to schools, and nothing bad happens to these kids. They just go on to very successful careers after the schools.
Dr. Allen, what's your early memories of these schools?
So, you know, Dr. Jarab sort of captures what I probably would say about this. My field work was in a university, and so most of what I know about secondary schools came from talking to students and teachers in the university, in which I was curious about some of these things. The one I guess, so I was interested in my work in the competition and, you know, what the schools and school leaders were doing in Kyrgyzstan in the late 90s and in the 2000s. And there were a lot of competing models and a lack of resources in Kyrgyzstan. And so the Gulen schools especially in the rural places where they seem to be more prevalent, were basically creating and setting up institutions where the local institutions had completely collapsed and there weren't any good alternatives when the budgets were impossible and all the educators were leaving the profession. The Gulen schools came and actually created schools in places that used to be schools but weren't doing so well anymore. That's where they got their foot in the door, and they did provide, and I'm not still wasn't able to find out where all the quality teachers were coming from. Many were probably coming from Turkey. So they provided opportunities and they provided resources. They provided, you know, classrooms with electricity and a whole number of things that were attractive, I think, to many of the rural, particularly the rural parents in Kyrgyzstan. And so they got started that way, and then they were comparatively successful in getting students on the Olympiads, and they got to be recognized as leaders. Although the public, you know, the state school officials and the leaders were often opposed to them as competition and as someone challenging the Soviet heritage in education, which they prized and were hoping to restore in some fashion. So that's the early days, providing actual good schools in places where they were disappearing, the government schools, and then they were, you know, seen as the place to send your child, if you could, to get and then they might get a scholarship and go on to the university, and then from the university, particularly the Turkish universities, they might actually get a job, which is one of the things that many high school parents were concerned about with the economy in Kyrgyzstan the way it was 2 decades ago.
Bruce, I know you have had some early expeditions in Central Asia. So what is your impression?
Well, you know, I think it offered another route for some of these families that probably didn't have very many options in the end. We know that in a lot of the children of the elites end up going to universities abroad. And we know in Kazakhstan's case that some of the Bolshak students have not only gone abroad, but then there's Nazarbayev University. So, you know, but that was pretty much for the elites, the big families in the countries. And I think the appearance of a school like the Gulen schools gave people a hope that maybe their children could get them into a good university, as Dr. DeYoung was just talking about, because, you know, left to their own devices, they have to compete not only against these influential families, but then there's also the question of money, you know, again, which plays to the elite families in these countries. And so if their children could get a good start at a good school and a good education, they have a much better chance of making something of themselves and going on to a quality university somewhere outside the country, maybe, and making something of themselves and becoming a dependent and hopefully contributing adult when they get a little older.
Dr. Alan DeYoung, in Central Asia, especially in countries like Kyrgyzstan, there were huge gaps after the collapse of Soviet Union, as you mentioned, for quality education. So their need for such schools are obvious. So what is that? Even in the United States, they have over, I believe, 140 schools running, and they are still expanding.
Well, you know, in the United States, we have in a lot of states, we have competition. We have a charter school movement here now, which didn't actually really exist 2 decades ago. And I would imagine, without having studied the American situation, I just know we've had several teachers through my university who were Gulen teachers. And they were, you know, the sample of people that I'm familiar with that were all teaching in the sort of the low-income inner city. So they're teaching, they're Turks, and they're working in Chicago schools, in charter schools in Chicago with extremely low-performing kids previously, and apparently they're somewhat successful. So I would imagine that the Gulen schools really are probably more prevalent in the rural places or the inner cities that have similar characteristics to the schools in Kyrgyzstan. They are poor kids, previously low-achieving kids. But again, that's something I haven't particularly studied myself.
Dr. Zhurab, here I would like to talk about a little bit about the objective of these schools from their perspective. Lots of people also talk about boarding school system that Gulen-affiliated academic institutions runs besides their schools, where students are provided with housing, where books from Gulen are read, his philosophies are discussed, and also basic religious principles are taught, and family values are encouraged, etc. Some parents might like it, but it certainly raises some sort of eyebrow about their intentions, objectives.
Well, that's a very difficult question, and I think that's possibly the most important question these days, is exactly what is the ultimate goal or life objective of the movement that we associate with Gulen, if there is such a movement indeed. And I think, and I'm just thinking, just there are two options. Either they don't really have any ulterior or hidden objective except just provide good education, some healthy, moderate sort of Islam, and modernizing sorts of Islam in these countries, or they are hiding something, and the government of Turkey and everyone else aligning with them have all the reasons to worry. Now, either of these options is not very good. And I think one reason that gives grounds for this, for these sorts of suspicions, is indeed, in the end, some sort of either secrecy or not complete, to the extent that they're not exactly fully open and public about the ultimate intent or the organizational model, if they have one, gives grounds for all sorts of guesses, sometimes very suspicious sorts of guesses.
Right. Bruce, what is your reading about the intention of these schools? Certainly, their activities are not limited with those schools. There are various other things going on. Different people has different name for that, but what is your reading?
Certainly, we'd like to believe that it's that this is a charitable thing to do, and that this Gulen and his people have decided that it's important for Muslims around the world to have not only a good education but a strong moral background at the same time. Many of us tend to be and believe that can't be all that there is to this. That there's some grander design that's behind all this that we just don't see. All I could say is that to date, the little bit of experience I've had running into these people in Central Asia, I did not sense that this was part of some greater global master plan or anything. It just did seem to be generally for the benefit of some of these people who might not have a chance otherwise. And I suppose in that respect, you could compare it a little bit to the Aga Khan. The Aga Khan, Eastern Central Asia, in Tajikistan and in Kyrgyzstan. So far, I haven't seen anyone, say anything, that there was some suspicion about what his activities were leading to in the future. I'd like to think it's that simple with the Gulen schools. Again, though, like I said, there tends to be this cynicism that's always prevalent these days that say that no one could just do something as a good deed. It's impossible. There's got to be some hidden motive somewhere in there.
And Turkey says that Gulen movement or his followers is behind what happened on July 15 in Turkey. So can Central Asian leaders remain indifferent on what the Erdogan is telling them about the Gulen in their or his suspected role behind the recent events in Turkey?
Well, the first thing I'd point out is that there's not been a huge amount of evidence that's supported the Turkish government's argument to date. The second thing I would point out is that Central Asia has much more serious problems with other Islamic groups, which are absolutely a threat to their government if they could get a foothold in Central Asia. And when you look at groups like the so-called Islamic State, the Taliban right next door, some of the smaller militant groups around there that are trying to spread their ideologies into the region. So by comparison, I would imagine that not only the government's there, but the people also would prefer to have the Gulen school types of organizations as compared to some of these other groups, which are very close or already present in the region.
So how we go from here, Dr. Allen? Yes, quality education, but also states have to run their own foreign affairs. So what is the way ahead for Kyrgyzstan, maybe to a certain extent to Kazakhstan?
Gee whiz. the political futures of these countries aren't something that I'm very, very much expert at. So the way ahead, I'm sort of the same as Bruce. I've always been skeptical of the organization and intent. I can never find it. I talk to people about how school leaders or school or university rectors are trained, and the answer has always been, well, they're not trained. They're just, you know, volunteers who they come along and they must have some workshops for non-specialists who are going to be developing whatever program, curriculum, undertaking they're going to do. And I found very little structure. The way forward, you know, I'm not sure how. I would think that the Gulen people would, if it was possible for them to be even more transparent, it might be helpful if, in fact, they have no design. I don't know how they will go about doing that, and I don't know what the forum is for people to say, hey, we really aren't specialists, we're just volunteers, and we're committed to doing good work. I don't, you know, how that plays out politically, I would imagine that Nazarbayev's approach is probably the best one for Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan. Other than that, I'm not sure what you would do.
Dr. Zhuraev, this is the question perhaps to you. Yep. So how do you see going forward, I mean, the right balance yep. for Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan in this political context?
Indeed. Well, I think it's not going to be a very easy or one day or quick solution. But down the road, I think certainly Kyrgyzstan's leadership would do one to adopt more of the Nazarbayev-style diplomatic, more moderated posture, and try to not jump at quick reactions and quick decisions on this. I think Turkish governments, and generally Erdogan himself, seem to be a little on the kind of the panicky end of political mood these days, and that certainly does not seem conducive to very productive relations. As for Kyrgyzstan, now, for some time already, as I understand, Kyrgyzstani schools have already become fully Kyrgyz, in the sense that, legally at least, they're all run and governed by directors, fully of Kyrgyz citizens. They only and exclusively report to under Kyrgyz laws. And what they can do in the future is just bring a bit more transparency, argue about exactly what they do in Kyrgyzstan, and I think maybe down the road just to try to have some discussion about what they do in Turkey, where I think if they have any agenda, political agenda, that probably applies more to Turkey, which has a very different, and in Central Asia, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, they just cannot have the same sorts of agendas or struggles on behind their minds. So I think that just needs to be understood. And in Kyrgyzstan, all of the range of organizations that they've been running or associated, charity organizations, business associations, education, universities, they're all really rather open, very transparent. I think that's what the Kyrgyz government needs to bring to the table.
Bruce, yes? We did discuss what the governments might or should be doing about this. So is there anything Gulen can do to be able to survive in the region going forward?
You know, just as much transparency as possible and work as closely as you can with the government to reassure them that there's no ulterior motives here for opening up these schools. You know, it just seems to be too good to be true sometimes, which is a bad way to base suspicion on anything. But, you know, certainly just to bring everything out, and anytime anyone has any questions about something or wants to take a closer look at something, they should comply with that. Do all that they can to show everybody that they don't represent any threat at all to these countries, and that they're only there to benefit the local people.
Okay, final remarks, Dr. Alandia.
No, I've learned a few things I didn't know, and I appreciate the discussion. Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Alandia, professor at the University of Kentucky, and also big thanks goes to Dr. Emil Zhuraev, professor at the American University in Central Asia, and Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlak Awazi, a Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Thank you, panelists, for being available for the Majlis. This was the first episode of the debate from Washington, D.C. I hope many more to come in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yep. Good luck. Thank you.
Thank you. And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, the Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Bye-bye.